Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the final months of peace before the Civil War play out, and what desperate efforts at compromise from preventing the bloodiest conflict in U.S. history? While there were insistent voices in the North and the South willing to endure armed conflict to settle long-standing differences over states' rights and slavery, there were also people on both sides working instead to reach compromise on these vexing issues, but who were ultimately unable to convince enough of their colleagues of the case for peace. William J. Cooper is a Boyd Professor at Louisiana State University and past president of the Southern Historical Association. He tells the story of this seminal but often overlooked period in our history in his new book, We Have the War Upon Us, The Onset of the Civil War, November 1860 to April 1861. Bill, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be with you.
So there were 18 free states, 15 slave states in 1860. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. How did that equate to the division of political influence in Washington?
Well, you would think it would mean that the 18 free states dominated the national government, but that was not the case. The 15 slave states, the South, had enormous political influence in Washington. That had been the case from the beginning of national history, from George Washington's time. In the 1850s, the two presidents were both Northerners, one from New Hampshire, one from Pennsylvania, but they were both Democrats, and they were both very inclined toward the South, with many Southern friends, and Southerners dominated the Congress. And for a number of Northerners, this didn't seem exactly the way things ought to be. For many Northerners, they even perceived this as somehow nefarious. They talked about a slave power conspiracy, and this is the Republican Party, the new Republican Party. This became one of the big rhetorical weapons, the slave power conspiracy, which meant somehow that this South inferior in numbers had too much power in the federal government, too much influence in the federal government, and the Republican Party said, we're going to set about changing this.
And there was some representation that came even from non-voting African-American residents of slave states because of the three-fifths rule.
Well, absolutely. Well, of course, there were lots of representation from non-voters because women couldn't vote either.
Mm-hmm.
But no, the Constitution provided that three-fifths of the slave population would be counted for representation. This was a part of the compromise that went into creating the federal Constitution back in 1787. And this number, this three-fifths number, gave the South and the slave states an additional number of representatives. Also, of course, an additional number of electoral votes, because, as you know, the electoral votes are the two senators plus the number of congressmen. In 1860, there were really 25 extra congressional representatives from the South because of the three-fifths clause.
Now, there were many Americans who were opposed to slavery by the late 1850s, early 1860s, but the majority of them, the prevailing wisdom was that the Constitution, in fact, protected slavery where it already existed. Is that right?
That's correct. There were a few extreme anti-slavery constitutional thinkers who propounded that the Constitution really didn't protect slavery, but they were very much on the periphery. Mainstream constitutional thinkers, even in mainstream politicians, even in the Republican Party, all assumed that the Constitution protected slavery in the states where it existed, and there was really no serious political contest about that. There was no serious effort on the part of any groups in the North to change thinking about constitutional protection for slavery in those 15 states.
And among those who opposed slavery, there were still a lot of really blatant white supremacists.
Oh, yes. I mean, we mustn't think that 1860 was 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all white Americans, as did most Western Europeans, they thought that the white race was superior to the black race. And the fact that slavery in the American South was racial slavery, went a long way toward making most Northerners willing to accept the fact that slavery existed in the South. There were very few proponents of what we would think of as racial equality, very few advocates of what we would think of as civil rights. In fact, in most Northern states, even in the Northern states, the free black population was heavily proscribed in certain ways. They couldn't serve on juries. For example, Abraham Lincoln's Illinois, there were draconian laws against free black African Americans. There were very, very few states in which African Americans had many civil rights, and most of those were in New England, where there were practically no African Americans.
Did Northerners object to the fact that slavery created some economic advantages for the South?
They didn't think that slavery so much about gave the South economic advantages. They thought that what slavery did was to change the nature of the white population, that slave societies, they thought, were dominated totally by rich planters, rich slave owners, who cowed non-slave-owning whites. And they really thought of almost three classes in the South: rich slave owners, poor whites, and, of course, the African-American slaves. They didn't perceive of the South as being a society in which there was what we would call a middle class of whites, whether they were in agriculture or non-agricultural pursuits. And what they didn't want was for the Western territories, for the average white northerner who would immigrate there to farm or to be a merchant or whatever, to have to compete with slaves, because they felt in a slave society that this great northern middle class had no place, had no role.
Okay, so Bill, let's talk about the political makeup of the United States in the late 1850s. You mentioned earlier that the Republican Party was relatively a new player on the scene. The Democratic Party had been around for some time. Talk about where the power was centered with each party.
Well, the Republican Party, let's start there, the new party. It came about in the mid-1850s because of the demise of the old Whig Party. Since the time of Andrew Jackson, from the 1830s into the 1850s, the political contest was between Democrats and Whigs. The Democrats were associated with Andrew Jackson. The Whigs were the opponents of the Andrew Jackson Democrats. But the Whig Party disintegrated in the mid-1850s, and in its place there was a competition to move up to be the chief competitor of the Democrats, and the Republican Party became the chief competitor. The Republican Party was a northern party, and proudly so. It did not have a significant southern dimension at all. And then the Republican leaders looked at the electoral map, and they said, we don't need any southern votes to win. We can gain enough electoral votes in the free states to win a national election without any votes from the slave states, electoral votes from the slave states. And so they built a party aimed at the North, for the North. All of its appeals were to the North, and in many ways what they appealed to the North by condemning the South. They tried to weld the North into a political unit by condemning the South as unprogressive, as undemocratic, and really as un-American. And the strength was solely in the North. The Democratic Party maintained a national base, yet its congressional power was dominated, in the Congress, Southerners dominated. It was a Southern-oriented party, though there were Northern Democrats across the board, and there were some very popular and notable Northern Democrats. And, of course, both presidents in the 1850s had been Northern Democrats, as I said earlier, one from New Hampshire, one from Pennsylvania.
So what kind of pro-Southern policies had James Buchanan put in place when he was president?
Well, I'll give you one major example. The flashpoint of sectional conflict in the 1850s was Kansas. Kansas was a territory. It was organized by Congress in 1854, and both sides went to Kansas, Northerners and Southerners, free soilers as they were called, and pro-slavery people, an attempt to wrest Kansas in one direction or another. Now, it is true that most people who went to Kansas went, the reason most Americans had gone west, to better themselves. They had no real interest in the sectional politics, but the zealots on both sides really took control in Kansas and made Kansas, as I said, a flashpoint. There was even violence in Kansas. There were burnings. There were killings. And in 1857, the pro-slavery forces in Kansas, through political maneuvers, put through a constitution and applied for statehood, and Kansas would become a slave state. Now, supposedly, this had been done above board, and in a technical sense, it had. But everyone knew that it had been done in a way that did not give all Kansans an opportunity to say what they wanted to say about their Constitution. Everybody in Washington knew this. Everybody in Washington realized that Kansas, the majority of those in Kansas, while not abolitionists at all, didn't prefer slavery. And yet the Constitution was going to guarantee slavery in Kansas. When it got to Washington, President Buchanan followed the lead of his southern congressional people, and he put himself behind the Lecompton, it was called the Lecompton Constitution, and tried to get it through the Congress. They got it through the Senate, but they failed in the House. This was a very pro-Southern move that Buchanan made, and it fractured his party because a number of Northern Democrats would not support this effort to make Kansas a slave state.
William J. Cooper is my guest. He's Boyd Professor at Louisiana State University and past president of the Southern Historical Association. His new book is called We Have the War Upon Us, The Onset of the Civil War, November 1860 to April 1861. We'll come back to our conversation with Professor Cooper in a couple of minutes and invite you to join us at 1-800-933-5372. If you would like to read a copy of the new book, We Have the War Upon Us, and support KERA, this is your lucky day. You can get in touch with us at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. We have copies available to thank you for a contribution of $120 or more. And Jeff Whittington has just stepped into the radio studio here. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And yeah, we would love to thank you with a copy of We Have the War Upon Us by Professor William J. Cooper, our guest this hour. Thanks to him for his patience during this quick fundraising break. I want to update everybody on where we are. Our goal this hour, 45 contributions for this second hour of Think Today. Your call to 888-694-6931 is the way to do it, or you can click and join online at kera.org. Chris, we've heard from a couple of folks already this hour. Thanks so much to each of you. 41 contributions left to go to make our goal and stay on track in our KERA 7,000 contribution 7-day membership drive. We can do it if you'll be the next one to contribute.
You support public radio because you believe that civil discourse is important. You believe that ideas are important. You believe that facts are important and that you have your own opinions and you're entitled to them and don't need them fed to you by those of us working in journalism. We're proud to be able to bring you that service. We are so fortunate, Jeff and I, to be able to bring you this show because you have an appetite for this, because you are as curious as we are about history and about civil rights and about ethics and about science and about politics and about art and about everything under the sun. It's fantastic to have you listening every single day that we put the show on. We also do need your financial support in order to create this program and keep up the standards that you have come to expect from KERA.
Yeah, it's really easy for you to do your part. Just call 888-694-6931. Set up a sustaining membership, $5 a month. That adds up to $60 for the year. And there are a number of different ways that you can be thanked if you want a thank you gift on the KERA.org page. There's the Think Mug, which is a $60 contribution. It's a black ceramic mug with the Think logo on it. The perennial favorite of Think listeners. It comes in really handy in meetings as well because you can hold it up and it says, Think. and so, we'd be happy to send that to you with our thanks when you join the station with a $60 contribution. Or if you want a copy of our guest's book this hour, William J. Cooper's book, We Have the War Upon Us. We'll happily thank you with one of those when you join with a $10 per month contribution as a sustaining member.
It's wonderful to hear from. We've heard from 13 of you thus far this hour. That's fantastic. We greatly appreciate and need your support. KERA.org is the telephone number. It's not the telephone number. KERA.org is the website. The telephone number is 1-888-694-6931. It takes literally about 2 minutes to get the whole thing underway. So you will be back in time for when we come back in just a moment with William J. Cooper to talk about his new book, We Have the War Upon Us. Thanks again for your support at 888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is William J. Cooper. He's Boyd Professor of History at Louisiana State University and past president of the Southern Historical Association. He's also author of the new book, We Have the War Upon Us, The Onset of the Civil War, November 1860 to April 1861. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. Bill, as I'm sure you know, for those of us who are not historians, it takes a little bit of thinking to remember a time when Abraham Lincoln was sort of new on the scene. But in fact, that was very much the case in 1860.
Oh, yes. Lincoln was very inexperienced. He had not held any public office except one term, since he had one term in the House of Representatives in Washington about a decade and a half before 1860. He had run for the Senate twice in Illinois in the 50s and lost both times. He was far from the leading Republican figure in 1860. The most notable Republican was a man named William Henry Seward, who was a senior senator from New York State. As Seward had been around, had been a Whig, well, Lincoln had been a Whig as well. Seward had been in Washington throughout the 1850s. He was a man widely known, widely respected, and almost everyone thought he would be the Republican nominee in 1860. That included Seward himself, but he didn't get it. He was passed over, and Lincoln got the Republican nomination. Of course, from our perspective, Lincoln is a towering giant. But in 1860, nobody knew what Lincoln was going to do. Few people knew very much about Lincoln. Many Republicans were nervous and anxious. After all, this is the first time their party had won a presidential election. They would take over the White House with a man that very few people knew, and they knew he was inexperienced. Moreover, they didn't control the Congress, and so even Republicans, while euphoric with their victory, were unsure about what was going to come about.
So what was in the Republican platform in 1860?
Well, the Republican platform said the kinds of things it usually said. It said the Republican Party was a progressive party, and the Republic, you had to elect the Republican candidate to save the Republic. In terms of slavery, they focused on the territories. That is, the areas the country owned, but were not states. In 1860, that was chiefly what we think of today as the Great Plains to the Rocky Mountains, and then from the Rocky Mountains westward to California. California and Oregon were states, but everything west of Missouri, Kansas, none of that territory, all of it was called territories. None were states. And the Republicans said there could be no slavery in those territories. They had to be for freedom, and they had to slavery had to be restricted because the future of the country, it must be a free country, not a slave country. They also talked about things like the tariff. They wanted an increase in the tariff, that is, a tax on imports. And they wanted various other things. But it was chiefly that the Republican Party was a party of progress, and the country needed to elect a Republican president to be progressive and turn out the Democrats.
And they were so new on the scene and so invested in ensuring that they grabbed onto power and held onto it that they were not really willing to bend on any of the things in their platform.
Well, that's not true. There were certain Republicans quite willing to bend. Even on slavery in the territories, which was sort of the granite of the Republican platform. The platform had a little bit of wiggle room in it about the territories, and certain Republicans thought that given the nature of the crisis that the country faced in 1860-61 after Lincoln's election, that the Republicans needed to bend a bit on slavery. And ironically, the man who became the most forceful advocate of such a bend or such a turn away from a strict hard line was William Henry Seward himself. And Seward had been passed over in favor of Lincoln in no small part because Seward had been perceived as too radical. He had spoken about a higher law than the Constitution and opposing compromise earlier. He had said there was an irrepressible conflict between the free states and the slave states. And Republican leaders feared that Seward was too radical to be elected, and they went for a man they thought of as more conservative, Lincoln, because in having to carry all the northern states to win, they worried about the southern tier of states like Ohio and Illinois and Pennsylvania that in those areas that Seward might not be able to get the votes they needed to carry those particular states. And so Seward was put aside. But in the crisis that came about after Lincoln's election, Seward was willing to compromise. He strove hard to work something out. Of course, he failed. Well, Lincoln, on the other hand, was adamant. Lincoln would not move at all on the territorial question.
So when you speak about a crisis, this is the secession of a number of states. By February of 1861, was it eight Southern states had seceded?
Seven.
And,
right.
and eight were remaining.
The crisis came about because there were a number of Southerners who were really frightened by the Republican Party, the Republican rhetoric. I mean, Seward had talked about an irrepressible conflict. The Republican rhetoric was aimed at the South and condemning the South. Lincoln had, in one of his most famous speeches, said the country could not continue to exist half slave and half free. And many Southerners were frightened. And there were those few Southerners, the extremists, who were known as fire eaters, who were secessionists, who were disunionists. And they had been advocating disunion for some time. I mean, they didn't begin advocating disunion when Lincoln was elected. But Lincoln's election gave them a spark. They could now tell Southerners, look, what's going to happen to you? You've got this party up there who's condemning us, this man we don't know who's going to be in the White House. We better act right now. And they started talking about secession. And legislatures began to call elections for conventions where people, where the delegates would come together and decide whether to secede. And in fact, on December the 20th, 1860, South Carolina became the first state to secede. In succession after that, over the next 6 weeks, going westward, seven states seceded all the way westward to Texas. So in February of 1861, seven states had seceded, and these seven formed the Confederate States of America. At the same time, eight slave states were still in the Union. But this took place over time, and while these states were seceding, there were efforts going on to try to find some sort of deal that Republicans would accept and that Southerners would accept to stop secession, at least in most of these states, and to keep the rest of the slave states in the Union.
How much did Lincoln know about the negotiations that Seward was involved in?
Well, Lincoln knew what Seward wanted to do. Lincoln had met with Seward's closest political confidant, a New York state editor by the name of Thurlow Weed, who was been a major player in the Whig Party and was a major figure in the New York Republican Party. He had met with Lincoln, and in his newspaper, Weed had propounded compromise on the territories. Lincoln knew about that, but Lincoln would have none of it, and he told Weed when they met in December, and Weed had gone to Springfield, Illinois, that he was not going to support that. He told his closer confidants in the Congress that he would not support any compromise on the territories. And when Weed came back from his meeting with Lincoln, Seward knew what Lincoln thought. And Lincoln didn't know everything Seward was doing, and Seward never got too far in front of Lincoln. But Seward kept trying to work something out. He kept trying to get Southerners, especially in the Upper South and border states, those eight states, not to secede. And he kept promising them that the Republicans were going to do nothing to harm them. And he kept telling Lincoln that Lincoln was going to have to be, he couldn't come into office trying to use force. He had to come into office trying to pacify people and to show people that nothing bad was going to come from Republicans, show Southerners that nothing terrible was coming from the Republicans.
Were there people in the North who were content to let the South secede?
There were a few, and there were some Republicans who were quite willing to let the South go, or at least they said they were.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most famous was a man named Horace Greeley, who edited the New York Tribune, the most widely read newspaper in a Republican newspaper. At the outset of the secession crisis, Greeley talked about letting them go, though Greeley changed his mind. There were some others who said, let the South go. They said that for two reasons. One, they said we would be rid of the moral blemish of slavery, and then also then Republicans could take control of the Senate, which they had no chance of doing as long as all the 15 slave states were in the Union. How serious these people were, it's really hard to know. They particularly condemned South Carolina. One said that they ought to do the South Carolinians what the American government had done to the Indians, march them away to someplace else and take over the state.
Hmm. So we know that, very few Americans could have predicted the length of, that the Civil War would drag on, the amount of human lives it would cost. But can you talk a little bit, Bill, about the perception among regular people about whether or not Congress would be able to work out some kind of compromise short of all-out Civil War?
Well, I think that early on in December, Lincoln was elected in November. The Congress came into session the beginning of December, about 1 month later. I think early on, many Americans, North and South, thought that some kind of congressional compromise would emerge because there was a precedent for that. I mean, since the Constitutional Convention in 1787, there had been several serious sectional crises. All had been settled by compromise. The Constitutional Convention to begin with in 1787, and then in 1820, the crisis over Missouri statehood and what to do with slavery in the Louisiana Purchase, which was much greater than the state of Louisiana. The Louisiana Purchase covered everything from the Mississippi River west to the Rocky Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a crisis about that in 1820 that had been solved by compromise. The nullification crisis between South Carolina and the federal government in 1832 and 33 that had been a congressional compromise. And then the crisis that erupted in the late 1840s over what was known as the Mexican Cession, the territory that came to the United States after the successful War of Mexico. It encompassed the modern Southwest plus California. That had been settled in the Compromise of 1850. So there was tradition and there was precedent for compromise to occur. And many felt that compromise would take place. And in fact, the House created a committee almost immediately, specifically instructed to try to find some sort of compromise. The Senate came to this same committee arrangement a little bit later, but still in December, to do the same thing. Of course, none of it worked out, but there were efforts made from the beginning, and there were people who were striving to do that. And as I said, I think from the early on, many Americans thought that that would happen. Now, there were two groups who didn't want it to happen. The Fire Eaters, the radical secessionists I've spoken about, didn't want any kind of deal in Congress. They feared it mightily because they knew that any deal in Congress would just blow up their hopes that it would probably kill secession. Likewise, the hardline Republicans, those on the left of the Republican Party, they wanted no compromise with the Southerners at all. They were willing to risk whatever it came about. Didn't want any compromise. And as it turned out, hardline Republicans and the secessionists got what they wanted, no compromise.
William J. Cooper is my guest. He's Boyd Professor at Louisiana State University and past president of the Southern Historical Association. We're discussing his book, We Have the War Upon Us, The Onset of the Civil War, November 1860 to April 1861. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We'll come back to our conversation about this topic in just a moment, and we invite you now to take a couple of minutes to support KERA. Perhaps you have been waiting for the day. This is a perfect day. You can receive a copy of We Have the War Upon Us by Professor William J. Cooper when you make a contribution of $120 or more, or you can make a contribution at any level. And there's a number of thank you gifts. If you want to check those out online, you can find them at kera.org. Jeff Whittington is back in the studio now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And everybody who contributes during the drive, by the way, remember, is entered into the drawing for this incredible 11-day getaway to Australia, 4 days in Sydney, 4 days in Melbourne, and some other activities in between. And it's all expenses paid. You're going to fly straight from DFW to Sydney on Qantas. It's worth about $11,000. It's been donated to KERA by Discover Down Under. It's the Discover Down Under Australia trip giveaway. You can get information on it online at kera.org. You don't have to contribute to be entered, but when you do contribute, you're entered automatically. So it's really, really easy to get in on this contest and to support your public radio station, KERA. Call 888-694-6931 or go online and click and join at kera.org.
27 contributions left to go in this hour in order to make our goal. You can get us that much closer when you take action to support public radio. It's something that you can feel good about because you are contributing not only to your own education, to your own source of information about the world, but it really is a community service as well, because we provide this station for anyone who can tune us in and listen, not just over the airwaves anymore, but even online and through the podcast properties and things like that. We want to be here when you need us, in the format in which you need us, and we are really excited to be able to do that. But it can only happen if we have the funds available to run the station properly. Your contribution now at 1-888-694-6931 ensures that we will be here to provide you great radio for another strong year.
888-694-6931 is the number to call. You might want to check out this really limited opportunity that we have for you on Monday, October 15th at the KERA studios. From 7 to 8 p.m. that evening, we're going to be presenting the Marketplace No Horse, No Race live election tour event. Marketplace is going to be here at KERA. Kai Rizdahl, host and senior editor of Marketplace, Patty Hirsch, the senior producer of personal finance at Marketplace, and also Chrissy Clark, who's the senior reporter for the Wealth and Poverty Desk at Marketplace. You've heard her series recently on the middle class, because the middle class has been a big issue in the election campaign. Well, Marketplace is going to be here, and you will experience engaging conversation, lively interviews, fun, unpredictable moments, and you'll also get the chance to interact with the team and experience this Marketplace show live for an hour. You can call right now to be part of the special live event. Reserve your seat with a $60 contribution, or if you make a $120 contribution, you'll get two tickets to Marketplace No Horse, No Race, the live election tour event on Monday, October 15th. Just call 888-694-6931. I think we've got less than 20 seats left for this event.
Yeah, and they are pretty intimate events. So you know, it's not going to be 8,000 people there. There are, I'm guessing, a number of dozens as opposed to a number of hundreds.
We'll say scores.
Know. Scores. Scores of people will be there, but you can arrive early, get
probably
a great
around
seat.
Around four score.
Four score and seven. if you would like to join now, you can do it lots of different ways. You can pay instantly with a credit or debit card. You can set up a sustaining membership. However you want to do it, you can go online to kera.org and make your contribution there. Also check out thank you gifts if you want. Your contribution will automatically get you enrolled in this fantastic drawing that we have for the special tour of Australia donated by Discover Down Under. You can call as well to make your contribution. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. Back in 2 minutes with Professor William J. Cooper.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is William J. Cooper, Boyd Professor at Louisiana State University and past president of the Southern Historical Association. He's got a new book out called We Have the War Upon Us, The Onset of the Civil War, November 1860 to April 1861. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Bill, tell us about Kentucky Senator John Crittenden, who today is not a familiar name, but was quite well known in 1860.
Well, Crittenden, what? He was a man who had been in national politics for more than a generation of 1860. He was a Kentuckian, so he was from a border state. He was a disciple of Henry Clay, who was also a Kentuckian, one of the leading American political figures in the first half of the 19th century. And Clay had gained a great deal of fame as a compromiser. I mentioned several compromises earlier, Missouri, the nullification crisis, the compromise of 1850. Clay had been instrumental in all three of those. And Crittenden tried to emulate Clay in 1860-61. He proposed a compromise settlement that was very complicated in a way, but the central feature was to extend the old Missouri Compromise line, which divided slavery and freedom in the Louisiana Purchase, to extend it westward through all the territory taken from Mexico, except for California, because California was already a state. And the Crittenden Compromise, it was called, became a focal point for efforts to settle the dispute in Congress. There were also various versions of the Crittenden Compromise proposed by other congressional figures, but Crittenden was a leading figure in trying to get some settlement throughout the entire period of the Congress. The Congress sat from early December until March the 4th, the day Lincoln was inaugurated. And those days, the second session of a Congress, this was the 36th, it went out of session the day the president was inaugurated. And so March the 4th, 61, the Congress adjourned. But throughout all, Crittenden had been a major player in trying to get something accomplished. And he made a speech the last night of the session in which he admitted failure, and he said it was remarkable to him that the representatives of the nation watching the nation come apart couldn't do something to save it.
Help us understand the significance of extending that line of the Missouri Compromise, because in some ways for the South it would have been more a symbolic victory, right, than one that would really expand slave territories?
Well, in many ways it was symbolic on both sides. Whether or not slavery could ever have existed out in those western territories is a vexed question. Some Southerners thought it could, other Southerners didn't think it could. But what all Southerners believed was that they had the constitutional right as an American citizen to take their property into territories owned by the nation. They were part of the nation. And this constitutional view was affirmed by the United States Supreme Court in 1857 in the infamous or famous Dred Scott decision. But on the other hand, Republicans said never, no matter what the Supreme Court said, that the Constitution gives Congress the power to prohibit slavery in the territories. Now, for Southerners to take slavery in the territories underscored their rights as American citizens. It underscored their identity as Americans. It also gave them a belief that the political future of the United States was not one that would shut them out. To maintain political power, new states had to come in, new states that were slave states. Likewise, on the northern, on the Republican side, they wanted no new slave states. Their whole object was to control slavery, and that was they had a political motive to ensure that the free states would dominate, and they had a moral motive to make sure that slavery didn't expand. Now, they didn't think slavery was going to go away anytime soon. Even Abraham Lincoln thought that slavery would last maybe another 100 years. And the one thing the Congress did propose was the original 13th Amendment. Now, we all know today the 13th Amendment was the amendment that abolished slavery at the end of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. The 13th Amendment that was proposed in 1860-61 and was, in fact, passed by both the House and Senate in the waning days of this Congress would have made the elimination of slavery in the 15 slave states almost impossible. It would have made slavery basically perpetual in those states. And even Lincoln, in his inaugural address, affirmed his support for this 13th Amendment. And if, in fact, the war hadn't come, it would absolutely have been added to the Constitution, because all it said was what most Northerners believed, of course, as well as Southerners.
How much will was there for peace on both sides going into the Peace Convention of 1861?
Now, the Peace Convention, this is a sort of an extra-legal kind of operation. There was really no precedent for it. It was a national meeting. People came from not every state, but most every state. It was called by the state of Virginia. It was an attempt to get around what they saw as the impasse in Congress, and of course we all know about impasses in Congress, to get around that by having delegates fresh from the people. And met in February of 1861. It did come up with proposals that were quite similar to the Crittenden proposals and to other congressional compromise proposals, but of course it would have to, whatever they suggested would have to go through Congress. They didn't get through Congress. The Congress did not accept the proposals from the so-called Peace Convention. The delegates in the Peace Convention, some of them were advocates for compromise, others were opposed to compromise. You had some of the same people there. You had Southern zealots and Northern hardliners who didn't want any kinds of compromise. But the convention did propose one, elements, but it didn't get through Congress.
So every school child in America remembers that the Civil War sort of began in earnest with the attack on Fort Sumter. But you remind us that there were still choices to be made even at this desperate moment.
That's right. You must remember that because Congress had adjourned without compromise, that didn't automatically mean that war would come. All the slave states hadn't left the Union. In fact, only seven had gone into the Confederate States of America. And people like Seward believed that if they could just maintain peace over time, that their erring sisters, so to speak, would come back into the Union. They couldn't stand on their own. The big problem was the military installations in the southern states that were still garrisoned by federal troops. There were two major ones, one in Florida at Pensacola, Fort Pickens, and one in South Carolina at Charleston, Fort Sumter. There were two others way down in the Florida Keys, but they were not central to what was going on. Now, from the time of the Buchanan administration, when secession first started, there was sort of an unwritten agreement on between the federal government and the state of South Carolina to start with, and then the federal government and the Confederate states, that nobody would do anything, that the federal government would not come in and try to reinforce those garrisons, that the states or the Confederate government would not try to subdue those garrisons. Some things would go day to day, week to week, and there were those like Seward who desperately hoped that men of goodwill would find some way to get around everything and shooting not occur. When the Confederate States was established, one of the first things Jefferson Davis did was to send a diplomatic delegation to Washington, D.C. He wanted the removal of the federal garrisons, and of course he was quite willing to pay for the public property, not only those two forts, but also other public property in the seceded states that had been taken over by the Confederate government. He sent that delegation to Washington, and they were in Washington for most of March of 1861 into April 1861. And there were efforts for them to negotiate with the federal government. President Lincoln would not have anything to do with them because he didn't recognize the Confederacy. Seward, who was the Secretary of State, would not meet with them officially, but through intermediaries, he carried on conversations with them. And Seward was still trying to get Lincoln to not to use force, and Seward tried to assure these Confederate commissioners that somehow peace would result. Of course, we all know it didn't quite work out that way because the federal commander in Charleston Harbor at Fort Sumter sent word to Washington in early March that his supplies were running out and that he couldn't maintain himself for more than six more weeks. President Lincoln got this news the day after he was inaugurated. It was shocking news because nobody expected this. The commander in Charleston had never let his superiors know that he was in this kind of dire predicament. And then the next thing he told them was that he could not be relieved because the Confederate defenses around batteries around the Fort Sumter had grown so strong that it would take such a massive force to get him out. And the commanding general of the United States Army, Winfield Scott, who was a military hero to Americans, he agreed. He told Lincoln that it couldn't be done. And Secretary Seward told Lincoln that they ought to withdraw the garrison. And so for a time, it appeared that President Lincoln might agree to withdraw the federal garrison from Charleston. But he decided not to do that.
The last thing I want to ask you, just briefly, how long do you think it would have taken to eliminate slavery had we not fought the Civil War?
Well, that's a perennial question we historians ask ourselves and play with. From my own point of view, and everybody has his point of view, I think slavery would have lasted in the Deep South at least until the early 20th century. I think in some of the border slave states, upper South states, it would have probably disappeared before then. But I think in states like South Carolina and Georgia and Mississippi and Louisiana, Texas, it would have lasted into the early 20th century.
William J. Cooper is a Boyd Professor at Louisiana State University and past president of the Southern Historical Association. His new book is called We Have the War Upon Us, The Onset of the Civil War, November 1860 to April 1861. Bill, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Thanks to all of you listening this hour. Really appreciate it. We especially want to thank those of you who have made contributions. We have 22 left to go in order to make our goal for this hour of Think Today. You can jump on the bandwagon of KERA supporters by going online right now to kera.org. When you do, you will instantly be entered in our drawing to win the fantastic once-in-a-lifetime trip to Australia, donated by Australia Down Under. Discover Down Under. And you can also do this when you make your contribution over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Hello again, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, I don't think I'm on.
Your microphone is not on, but
oh,
now
on
it's
now.
On.
I'm on
there
now.
We go.
Here we go. Thanks, Shelley Kennedy. Yeah, the number is 888-694-6931, or you can go online to kera.org. We did have a goal of 45 contributions this hour. Chris, just 20 left to go. That's actually a better position than we were in the last hour with the last break. So make that call right now to 888-694-6931. If you make a contribution of $120 or more, or do $10 a month as a sustaining member, you can set that up on the phone or online at kera.org. We'll send you with our thanks a copy of Professor William J. Cooper's book.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. The reasons that you would support KERA are the same reasons that you listen to KERA, because you think quality information is important, because you want to be able to explore all kinds of ideas, because you want to have the latest news as soon as it's available. All of those reasons are things that are worth paying for. You know, information these days is more valuable than it's ever been. Your contribution makes it possible for us to bring you high-quality information, for us to fill the hours with facts and ideas and explorations rather than opinions and shouting and a lot of arguing that just fill up time.
And we're able to revisit some historical situations that are very interesting. We know the Civil War and Civil War history is a very interesting thing to many of you in the audience, and that's why we thought that talking to Professor Cooper from LSU about his book, We Have the War Upon Us Today, might be very interesting, and it was. It was fascinating. If you enjoyed that, then this is worth a little bit of financial support. Look, it just takes a few dollars. This is a drive that we're trying to wrap up in record time. We're trying to get the requisite 7,000 or so contributions that are necessary to keep the station fiscally healthy this fall. We're trying to do that in 7 days. You know that previous membership campaigns have taken longer than 7 days, in some cases much, much longer than 7 days. So if you get on board right now, we could probably wrap this drive up this week and get it done within our goal of 7 days.
It takes just a couple of minutes of your time, and if you set up a sustaining membership, I pretty much won't even notice in your monthly budget as the money comes from your checking account into the KERA membership account. But we will notice that money makes a big difference, and we put it right to work. The wonderful thing about becoming a member of KERA, a donor to KERA, is that you get to check in anytime you want, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Check in on what your money's doing for you and for the entire community of North Texas. You can find this out when you tune in on the radio. You can find out online when you look at our always expanding website and the content that's offered to you there. You make it happen. Your contributions make KERA. We exist at all because of people like you who donate to the station.
You probably use the phrase, gosh, I heard on NPR the other day, or I heard on KERA the other day, or did you hear that story on KERA this morning? If you use that phrase once a month, you probably use it once a week. Maybe you even say it once a day. And if you're not a contributor, well, this is a great opportunity today to get on board with KERA and to do your part. Perhaps you joined several years ago. Perhaps you joined a different station and you moved to North Texas since then. Well, that membership is not really transferable unless you make the call to 888-694-6931, or unless you go online to kera.org and click through there to the donate page and make your contribution online. We're counting on you here in North Texas to help fund this public radio station so that it stays strong and healthy for you, and so that we can get back to reporting on the news that you want to hear. You deserve to hear up-to-the-minute, up-to-date news, especially in a political election year like this one. We've got 6 weeks till Election Day from today, and we want to be able to get back to the full range of programs that we're able to bring you every single day so that you can stay on top of what's happening in the election campaign.
You enjoy the station. You rely on the station. Obviously, you think somebody should be giving money to KERA because you come to us every single day. Why not you? Why are you thinking someone else should give money and not you? The amount really is entirely up to you, but you will feel good about your contribution to public radio, to civil discourse, to this show, frankly, when you make your contribution. And it just takes a couple of minutes of your time at 1-888-694-6931.
You'll be supporting your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, and streaming online, of course, all the time at kera.org. When you visit kera.org, you can click on the donate tab at the top of the page there or any one of the banners that says support KERA, and you'll be whisked to our safe and secure donation page there. Or you can pick up the phone and call if you prefer a human moment. Talk to a friendly person when you call 888-694-6931.
Give $120 or more, and you can choose as your thank you gift a copy of William J. Cooper's book, We Have the War Upon Us. You can also choose Lynn Povich's book from the first hour of the show, The Good Girls Revolt. Both of those are available. We would love to hook you up when you make your contribution at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. Thank you.